Dan.
I'm JJ.
And I'm Ben.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles.
Welcome to the Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast about impossible crime fiction. Now, readers, I know you're confused. You need not adjust your earpieces or your speakers. You are absolutely right. The level of handsome coming through the microphone has gone up several fold this month. We're absolutely delighted to welcome another guest, two podcasts in a row. We have with us Ben, who you should, and if you don't, you really should know from his blog, The Green Capsule. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So we thought Dan has a blog and is a little bit obsessed with impossible crime fiction. Ben has a blog and is a little bit obsessed with impossible crime fiction. I have a blog and I'm a little bit obsessed with impossible crime fiction. So we thought we'd meet up and discuss the musical Mary Poppins.
Yes.
It just seemed logical. Obviously, we are going to discuss impossible crime fiction. And if you wish to discuss impossible crime fiction, where do you go? You go to the Doyen. You go to Mr. John Dixon Carr.
We are back at the British Library. We are in the Knowledge Centre here.
Because so we deemed it safer to meet in a public place, just in case.
Yeah. Things are all strange. Yeah. Yeah. And we've, over the last sort of half an hour, we've been chatting, and again, me and Jim pretending that we know what we're talking about. It's been going good so far. Yeah.
This came about really organically, because Ben emailed us to say that he was coming over and to suggest meeting up, and I tentatively suggested... Maybe did he fancy meeting up to record a podcast episode? Not entirely sure what his response would be. His response was a 14-point plan, breaking down the career and the works of John Dixon Carr. So it's fair to say he was quite up for this. Is it fair to say you were quite up for this?
Oh, yes.
Can you just confirm to everybody at home that you are not being held here against your will?
I'm not locked in a room.
Yeah. Nice. So we've got a bit of a structure where essentially we are going to run through. Ben's got this really nice idea about the way in which Carr's career divides up into various phases. Broadly speaking, this is going to be a sweep through that, a bit of a discussion about trends, about utilisation of characters. We will do our absolute best, obviously, to be spoiler-free. We've discovered in conversations before this the mix of Carr novels that all three of us has actually read is terrifying, so it's a little bit...
There's not always crossover.
No, there really isn't. So it's going to be tricky enough for us, so don't worry, we're going to stay away from spoilers. If there's anything spoilerific, firstly we'll check out all of us have read it, and we'll give you plenty of warning, just in case.
But before we jump into looking at Carr's entire career and all of his books in detail over the next 6.5 hours, I thought we'd begin first by... just kind of getting a sense of our relationships to John Dixon Carr's work. Obviously, everyone comes to Carr's novels for different reasons and from different places, and it's been fascinating to hear each other's stories, but maybe that's a good place to start. And Ben, if we start with you, what was the first Carr book that you read, and then what really got you stuck into Carr's work?
I tiptoed into Carr via the short stories with The Wrong Problem and The Blind Man's Hood, making me decide to take the full plunge with The Hag's Nook. This was an interesting first in that it had the dense atmosphere. It had kind of a sense of adventure that I looked for in novels when I was younger, and I really liked that. But also, if you've read the story, Carr does something at the end with the twist and the solution where, at the time in my reading career, I just didn't know that was possible from this sort of novel. And that hooked me to an extent. I think what really got me full in, though, was The Problem of the Green Capsule, in which the problem of how a man could be murdered in front of a room full of people witnessing the entire thing, and yet nobody could explain what exactly they had seen, and none of the stories lined up. At that point, I was in even more. I think, though, JJ is maybe responsible for getting me full in by convincing me to read Death Watch. The reason was that this was supposed to be a bad car. And I read that, and I was like, this is an excellent book, and I want more of this. And if this is a bad car, then I'm all in at that point.
Cool. So did you go straight from Hag's Nook to Green Capsule?
No. In between, I had The Nine Wrong Answers, which is, looking back, very different from Carr's other books, maybe more of a historical set in modern-day England, still maintaining some of the core, you know, for him, modern-day elements of the story.
Death Watch was, for me, I think, probably the book that convinced me to read everything Carr had written. Like I said before, I'm sure that
Constant Suicides was a really early one for me. I think it was like the second one I read. And I read it and I was like, wow, this is brilliant. And I came to Death Watch without any perception of what it was going to be like at all. And I just love how the first half gets more and more insanely ridiculous and more complex and makes less sense as you go. And you're just like, this is never, he's going to wake up and it's all going to be a dream or something like this. And then steadily the second half just so calmly, so beautifully unravels it. And I just remember getting to the end and being like, why did that ever appear complicated?
Like, that's great.
How did I think this was so complicated?
Yeah.
And I just remember sitting, I was reading Australia at the time, and I just remember I sat out in the sun when I finished reading, and I just sat there and I was like, this is amazing. Like my mind has been blown. I must, not because I knew anything, like you say, you told it was a bad car and you discovered how much, I was just like, this is astonishing, and I must read, not just more, but everything.
He starts with a simple idea and then winds it tighter and tighter and tighter to this point to where you just see no way out. Mm. And then it is all backed by such a simple answer.
Mm. It's reminiscent of Christie's Five Little Pigs in that way, for me. The way in which that first half kind of sets up the situation. Yeah, you're just like, what? How is there a way out of this? And yeah, you're absolutely right. The answer to it, the way it kind of all unravels. I mean, the Christie thing is obviously, there are fewer threads going on in there, but I always put those two together in my brain. If someone says they really like Death Watch, a bit of me goes, oh, then you'll love Five Little Pigs, and vice versa.
My first car was the Hollow Man, and again,
never heard of that one. Yeah. What an unpredictable starting point. Tell us more about this Hollow Man.
This obscure novel of his.
I think Martin Edwards mentioned that one, actually.
Yeah,
I meant to write the title down, but
yeah, it's one you should get to, I think.
Right.
In fact, you haven't read it then.
I have not read The Hollow Man.
And I read it on my phone. And it was, you know, late at night, trying to, like, get through it.
Not one of those old Bakelite rotary dial phones.
Letter by letter, you know. it was at the time when I really didn't, again, know much about this type of work. And we mentioned this in our podcast when we looked at our top 15 Locktroom works, that there's such a mythology around the Hollow Man that I thought, oh, this is what is supposed to be, you know, his best, so I'll read that. And I just had a terrible experience with it. It's so dense a book anyway, against the rest of Carr's work, and trying to read it on a phone at night, it just was all too much.
Mm.
So I kind of had a difficult start, but I could see the merit of it. Then it was getting to He Who Whispers and Till Death Do Us Part, where it's the kind of book where you were just describing, JJ, and when you're just walking around afterwards like, how did that just occur? You know, and this is actually possible with this type of fiction. And yeah, I was hooked from then, really.
Ben, do you think you have a perception of what it's going to be like to read the book? Like, because it's something which is so discussed. You know what I mean? So, for instance, if I were to say, what's it going to be like to read The Punch and Judy Murders? You're going to be like, well, I know literally nothing about that book.
I actually think The Punch and Judy Murders will be kind of like The Unicorn Murders. That's my impression.
The Punch and Judy Murders is, I think, Carr's most brilliantly unheralded title. I honestly think there is not enough love in the world for The Punch and Judy Murders. It is a gorgeous, wonderful book. But that was not my question. My question was, stop avoiding the question. No, it's something about which there is so much discussion. It's unavoidable to have come to it without, go back to Agatha Christie. It's like Murder on the Orient Express or Roger Ackroyd. It's going to be so difficult to come to it without any preconceptions whatsoever. I'm just interested.
So unfortunately, I do have preconceptions in that I ruined it for myself early on reading some blogs, and I actually do know the solution to the crimes. Which is truly unfortunate to not get to go through. This does somewhat play, though, into our discussion that we'll have in terms of Carr's career, in that I'm curious to see how it really fits in there. I somewhat think of books surrounding it, like The Mad Hatter Mystery, Death Watch, as being somewhat of a different type of crime than Carr's later works that we all think of the impossible crimes. And yet sitting there, you have The Hollow Man, which very much feels like his canonical Fell. And I'm really interested to see if it reads like a Death Watch or Mad Hatter, or if it really reads more along the lines of a later book.
That's interesting.
I mean, we discussed this a little bit before, as I mentioned, but I'm just becoming more and more convinced that the reason it's so mythologized is for the Locktroom Lecture, you know, and it's that, I mean, it's obviously a great book as well, and it's a classic Locktroom in terms of the setup, but I think it's one of the few things that people say, oh, this is a car to read, this is what happens. And then there's this thing as well, which was like postmodern for the time, etc., etc. So it's kind of lauded for a kind of funny angle on it, if you know what I mean, and then some of the rest gets forgotten.
And yet The White Priority Murders isn't lauded for its Footprints in the Snow lecture.
Mm.
The Green Capsule has a poison lecture.
Yep, that's very true. Personally, I am not a fan of the book The White Priority Murders. Like, he's just rolled his eyes at me. I really like the book of The Hollow Man. I have said on microphone before, I believe it's in one of our earlier episodes, I do not feel that I read The White Priory Murders. I feel like I fought The White Priory Murders. The solution to the impossibility is genius. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful solution to a brilliant problem stuck in a book that is nowhere near good enough for the sheer amazingness of just how good that solution is.
Let me take that and make it into another question. Seeing as we've kind of talked about what got us into car, if someone was coming to car now and we were recommending something, what would you recommend? Seeing as we've all read quite a different selection of his works and there's gaps in all of our knowledge at this stage, what would you recommend, Ben? What would you start with?
You know, I'm tempted to say The Hag's Nook, even though that was my very first one.
Oh,
I think you get such a mix of what I personally look for in Carr. You get that atmosphere, you get a mysterious hidden treasure and some weird ritual and you wonder what's going on with it, and of course there's a simple answer behind everything. But you also get that element of misdirection that I think really captures Carr best. The one I've actually had the most success with, though, lending out to others to read is actually, comically, Death Watch.
Interesting.
I lent that to a friend, in fact, just 3 weeks ago, and I force-fed him through a series of these novels, and he said, this is my favorite one. I think it was that spin of the solution that was so unexpected, which is really odd, because the same friend has read, you know, what I think we would all classify as our top 15 Carr novels.
Okay, yeah.
So
that's really interesting. JJ, what about you?
I can't quite decide. I have on my blog a very early post entitled Starting John Dixon Carr.
Yes.
Nice.
Which is a list of 5 books to read to get into Carr. 5 books that were readily available at the time to get into Carr. The 5th one is The Hollow Man, because I maintain that The Hollow Man should not be anybody's first Carr, because it is a very heavy and a very dense book. I would probably go for something like The Emperor's Snuffbox, because there's a wonderful simplicity to it.
Hmm.
Depending on how well read one, I saw through it when I read it, but there is a beautiful simplicity to what it does that I think the way it takes a situation, again, which seems almost insoluble, there's a lovely piece of physical evidence which doesn't make any sense, and the way that gets resolved and the way that gets, you know, you go very, very quickly from what the hell to, oh yeah, of course, that's really obvious. There's a really nice moment that I think Carr, probably more than anyone, set up and achieved those seeming incongruities, is probably the best word, again and again and again.
It may be a good bridge too for someone who's used to maybe Agatha Christie, in terms of it being a bit of a, on the surface, a conventional mystery with such a head-snapping twist.
Mm. I have also lent people Till Death Do Us Part as their first one, just because sometimes you just want to impress someone.
How many
hours of your life do you spend doing this stuff? Oh yeah,
yeah.
Countless. Why? This will explain.
This is why, yeah.
So sometimes I've lent some people that. I also think it's, again, I'm a bit of a champion of the slightly less heralded cars. I really like The Bowstring Murders.
Mm. Oh yes, yes.
The Bowstring Murders was one that I read fairly early on, and again, I knew nothing about any of them going in, and I just really like it. It is flawed, it is problematic, it is far from perfect, it is immensely readable, it's actually one of the few multiple murder books where the later, so you've got the first murder which is under investigation, and then inevitably someone discovers something and is killed, and someone else discovers something or remembers something and is killed, like on Death on the Nile, say. Bowstring is one of the ones where there's such great motivation for the later killings, and it ties into a plot, certainly one of them, it ties into the plot really, really nicely, and it's a very easy read. and it's, I think it's quite a good one to take out of context as well, because it's not part of a series. You don't have to know about Fell in his obstreperous nature, or HM in his, you know, in his afternoon naps or whatever else.
I would certainly give away Till Death Do Us Part, you know, especially if someone maybe wasn't going to commit to really getting into Carr or something, and they were just going to have one experience. I think that's a really good example, like you were both saying. But also, it's what part of Carr do you want to introduce? Do you want to introduce the macabre? Do you want to introduce the impossibility? Do you want to introduce characters? Do you want to introduce humour? Do you want to introduce
puzzle?
Setting? Puzzle? Yeah, there's so many angles. So I could easily recommend something like He Wouldn't Kill Patients for the kind of context and the ideas and where the whole thing is set and how that works, even though it might be seen as kind of a lower tier car. But then as I've been mentioning a few times, I have this kind of theory of the kind of mega monolithic cars and then the more experimental, and no one's better than another, but they have a very different feel in terms of the book. So if I was going to give someone something more experimental and fun, like, I could go down that route, or then, you know, I could come back to She Died a Lady as well, which the solution may shock people, they may not agree with it, but you'll just be in this seething atmosphere the whole time. So it depends kind of what the reader likes and wants. The same with The Reader Is Warned as well. If you want atmosphere and kind of amazing ideas, Carr did so much. He didn't just write one type of book, which is obviously often how he's described. He wrote so widely within the genre that there's so many angles you could approach it from.
The first novel you listed, Till Death Do Us Part, may be the best front-to-back read in terms of Carr, in terms of just pacing and the rate of reveals that you get, them, you know, your mind's getting spun around by the setup of the problem and then some double fake that occurs all the way through to the end.
And actually, similar with He Who Whispers, the pacing of that is also superb. And when you go from location to location and how that moves is just,
I liked it a lot less when I reread it. I felt like that the first time I read it. But then when I came to reread it for the spoiler warning that Brad and I did for that and Death on the Nile, it's weird. I did not enjoy the structure of it quite so much. Maybe I went in convinced that I was going to love it. And so, I don't know, it's an odd one. But I feel something like Eight of Swords does a great chapter-by-chapter reveal. There are two chapters towards the end where someone just follows someone around, which unfortunately really takes the pace out the end of the story. But apart from that, I think, again, for pacing, it's beautiful, and it has a comedy bishop in it as well. So.
What could be better? It'd be interesting to read something like Till Death Do Us Part again and see if it had that same pace.
Yeah,
because I was, again, lucky enough to come to Till Death Do Us Part with no preconceptions, found it secondhand and thought, I'll go for this, and just was blown away. But then maybe even this podcast is saying too much. I don't know. There's something to be said for not knowing anything about a work and what that does to the way you read it versus what you know. And unfortunately, if you do know the solution, as you were just saying, Ben, about The Hollow Man, how that changes your perception of an author in their entirety, actually, as well as singular books.
The takeaway from all of this is forget everything you just heard.
Indeed.
That thing you mentioned earlier, Dan, about depending on which style, which facet of Carr's writing you wish to highlight when you give somebody their first Carr novel, ties rather perfectly into Ben's idea of how Carr's works overall break down into a series of eras. Ben, could you talk us through your thinking?
So John Dixon Carr published approximately 70 novels in between 1930 with It Walks by Night and 1971 with The Hungry Goblin. The most obvious place to start would be with his early works, the Ben Collin, starting in 1930 with It Walks by Night, Castle Skull, The Lost Gallows, The Waxworks Murders, and I'd kind of tuck into that Poison and Jest. Now, Poison and Jest does not include Ben Collin, although it does include his partner in crime. It takes place in the United States, but it reads very much like a Ben Collin book. I found that It Walks by Night starts Carr's career very much the way we would expect, with this killer impossible crime. How did this man get beheaded in a room that was observed from all sides? And of course, it has his trademark twist. As you go through the next four books, though, Castle Skull, The Lost Gallows, Poison and Jest, or The Waxworks Murder, you don't really have that impossibility, really. You have an incredible amount of misdirection, but there's nothing really quite like what you're going to get from his later era, such as when we move over to The Bowstring Murders.
That's really interesting, because out of that first five books, I've only read It Walks by Night, and it seemed like just a map to me of Carr's career to come. You know, it was like, wow, this is everything. And of course, the writing is very dense, very macabre. He's coming off the back of Poe, as I've written about elsewhere, and you think, okay, this is a little heavy-handed in places, a little overly poetic, but you know he's going to rein it all in. So it's interesting to see that he then doesn't necessarily stick with the impossible crime thing and the puzzle thing straight away to begin with. Do you think he's finding his feet in these first five books then, and then moving to a more classical car?
I think he's asking you.
I question whether at this phase in his career, Carr had really settled in on that idea of I'm writing impossible crimes. You could argue there's an element of impossibility in his second novel, The Lost Gallows, where you have, you know, a limousine driving down the streets of London with no driver, but I'd consider that a very light impossibility. Really, I think you see him, you know, trying his hand at various degrees of misdirection. Castle Skull, crazy misdirection, and the ending of that one really comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
The Corpse in the Waxworks, you almost get a little bit more of the bravado of his historical novels from later in the career with the action, but then there's this brilliant clue that Carr just dangles in your face, and I can't imagine anybody learning who the killer is in that novel without just smacking themselves on the forehead. Mm.
It's interesting as well how few of the novels he wrote in this early period, even once you get past the Benkelin books, just looking ahead, there are not a tremendous density of impossibilities in these first 10, 12, 13, 14 books.
The density of impossibility really comes with the early Carter Dixon books, right? I mean, we have the Bowstring Murders, which is, you know, quasi-Carter Dixon, but then with those early Merrivale stories, starting with the Plague Court Murders, the White Priority Murders, Red Window Murders, and anything that has the word murders in it, essentially is just so impossibility-heavy. But you're right, in the early Fell novels, you really don't have much in the way of impossibility, but you do have this tremendous amount of misdirection that occurs.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the first few Fells, you've got Hagsnook is not impossible, Mad Hatter is not impossible, Blind Barber is impossible, people don't like it, it's a superb impossibility, it's not a very good book, but it's a superb impossibility.
But even then it's quite light,
yeah,
on referencing it.
Yeah, very true. Eight of Swords, not impossible, Death Watch, not impossible.
So
we've
so interesting.
Got
yeah.
through this opening salvo of Fell's career. Fell, who would probably go on to be, I think, probably the better of Carr's two long-term series detectives, I
Agreed.
Think, who would become known as this slayer of impossibilities. And actually, there isn't a tremendous amount of impossibility. I mean, he only wrote 25, I think, Fell books in total. So the first 20% of Fell's cases actually only feature one impossibility, and that's the one that he's barely in and everybody hates.
And then there's fascinating to think the next book is The Hollow Man, which is so impossible heavy and has the impossible locked room lecture in it as well. So to think that Fell in his career, if you see it that way, hasn't been necessarily solving all these impossible crimes, and then to suddenly come with this super rich one, that's quite interesting.
And then he isn't really featured in another impossible crime until maybe The Problem of the Wire Cage, maybe the first true impossibility after The Hollow Man, which came out in 1939.
Is there an extent, just look at this, it just occurred to me now, is there an extent then, is it Fell in chapter 17 of The Hollow Man holding forth on impossible crimes in this now legendary impossible crime locked room lecture, that is John Dixon Carr discovering the impossible crime?
Yeah.
He has gone away, he's written a couple, he's gone away, done his reading, probably looked through whatever classics exist to that point. That's a debate for another time.
Yeah.
And he has come back, and that is him, suddenly so puffed up on the enthusiasm of this thing that he's discovered, And he's read voraciously, he's torn them apart, he's seen all of the trends, and suddenly he gets the wind in his sails, and he's like, right, this is how it's done. Here I am at the beginning now of my... I'm going to take these on. Here's everything that's been done, and I'm going to do better.
The Hollow Man sits right in the middle of a pack. You have the Plague Court murders, the White Priority murders, the Red Window murders, the Unicorn murders surrounding it. And these are all just quite possibly Carr's finest impossibilities in some sense of setup of the puzzle, and in many senses the actual, you know, trick solution to it. So it's interesting that it came in this strong wave of 1934 and 1935, and The Hollow Man is the only Fell novel in there, right? The rest are Merivale. Now, I think it very much is Fell delivering that lecture. Fell is the one to lecture, such as at the end of Death Watch, very much, so more than Merivale. But it feels as if at that point in his career, John Dixon Carr was pushing the possibilities more towards what he was releasing under the Carter Dixon name.
Mm. I think that's absolutely fascinating. Looking at these books in order, it really helps you to see how his career built up. And I think I'd like to think that you're right, Jage. I'd like to think that there is something of a bursting forth of saying, okay, I'm going to tackle this genre. And not only am I going to tackle it head on, I'm going to already tell you what's already been done, satirize it in a way, poke fun at it, and then, like you said, say I can do better, and then do better as well. Come out with the Red Widow murders straight after that, and then, you know, as we blast on later, some of his best works. So are we into stage two now of your kind of view of Carr? Are we into the second era, or where are we now?
Well, I think there's two parallel eras, right? So after Ben Collin, after the initial Ben Collin books, you have these early Merivale novels that are just so heavy on impossibility. They have this great hook in them, you know, the Red Widow murders with the room that kills, the Unicorn murders with a man murdered in the middle of a hallway in front of witnesses all over the place.
By a unicorn.
Yeah, by
not just murdered by a unicorn.
That's a hook in the
heart. And probably one of my favorite solutions, and one of the few that I've actually figured out right immediately when I read it.
Nice.
But you have this going on with Merivale, but then at the same time you have Fell pursuing these interesting misdirection-based novels that read somewhat plainly on the surface, right? Nobody's going to pitch the plot of the Mad Hatter mystery or Death Watch or maybe even the Arabian Nights mystery to somebody and really captivate that imagination and say, oh, I want to read this review.
Yeah.
But the insanity that you hit towards the end of that novel when you realize how, you know, everything that you saw was in essence, I don't know, maybe even illusion in some sense. It's really fascinating that that's the arc that Fell took until, you know, you could argue Fell takes over the impossibilities around the time of The Problem of the Wire Cage.
So we've covered these parallel eras of Fell and Merivale and all those beginnings. What's next, Ben?
Well, The Four False Weapons is a Ben Collin novel, and so it kind of stands in the middle of this era, and you may question, does it just kind of fold into first era Ben Collin? I would argue no. It reads very much more so like a Fell novel, I think. You could imagine Fell perhaps being in that novel with the detective written very differently, as at that point Ben Collin is a shadow of his former self.
There is, seems in my memory to be quite an extended bit where he goes on about how when I was younger, when I was first solving cases, I went out of my way to be aggressive and I went out of my way almost to be this deliberately unlikable sleuth. And it feels almost like sort of metafiction in that regard. It's Carr saying, well, I tried with this guy to make him very unlikable.
Yes.
And now it does feel like he's almost got unfinished business with Ben Collin, and then he wants to kind of tie it off by giving us this. I mean, how many years was it between Ben Collin novels? So it feels almost like he's had 6 years of going away and experimenting with more of what he wants to become, but he still feels he has some unfinished business with Ben Collin, and so he can almost kind of go in and make this. I always think it's quite interesting, the subtitle is something like On Being the Return of Ben Collin. I always think a better subtitle would be On Being the Apology of Ben Collin. Because he's like, oh, I was this really horrible kind of very aggressive man, and I'm not like that anymore. I don't have any ideas anymore. You know, it's almost like Carr just wants, for some reason, but it's almost as if Carr just wishes to kind of tie that off because he's now found the idiom in which he's more comfortable writing. And you're right, it is absolutely a Fell plot. The plot development is not hugely dissimilar to the plot development of, say, the Eight of Swords in terms of setup and the way it grows out from the central idea. The two thematically are incredibly similar, and so you're completely right, it does very much feel like this parallel era.
Now, in the same year of 1938, I think this is where you see Fell start to transition. So the previous Fell book was The Arabian Nights Murder, which to me feels very much similar to Death Watch or The Mad Hatter Mystery. In 1938, though, we get Two Wake the Dead and The Crooked Hinge. And to me, these just read so much more like The Problem of the Green Capsule, The Problem of the Wire Cage, Till Death Do Us Part. These... What we might consider classic Fell, right? When we really think of Fell, I think we're thinking of these novels. To Wake the Dead is not an impossible crime. The Crooked Hinge is not an impossible crime, although it temptingly could have been. But it feels more like these later novels. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely do. I feel I have a theory that actually The Crooked Hinge was written a lot earlier, because to me it feels like right back at the beginning. It feels like something from 1931, from 1932. The solution to it is famously rather controversial. I have a theory that maybe he started writing it, or maybe he actually wrote it in its entirety in the early 30s, sat back and went, it's a bit early to be putting this out, so then just kind of held on to it until he had made a bit more of a name, so probably reworked it, put a different detective in, but I would be very surprised if it wasn't a plot from earlier in his career. There is definitely a sense of transition. I personally think To Wake the Dead is a great book. It is a slightly awkward read because it feels to me very much like Carr is aware of how he used to write and has a sense of how he wants to go on to write. And it feels like somebody having this seismic shift under them as they are writing a book.
Then to think that after this are going to come things like The Problem of the Green Capsule, The Judas Window, like stone cold kind of classic Carr stuff. It appropriately named Crooked Hinge feels like kind of hinge moment for him where he's really starting to find his feet at this point, or at least enjoying his writing a lot more and then really kind of experimenting with it. And so I wonder if we could combine those things of, like you were saying, JJ, if it's an early idea, maybe he even saved it because he wanted to be able to be better, to write it better in the future, you know, as well as having the maybe being a bit too risque for the time period beforehand. I don't know, but he succeeds with it, and then from there we're blasting into some amazing work.
At this point in his career, he's just plotting perfectly, right? He's pacing the novels perfectly. I mean, looking at the books around this, The Crooked Hinge, The Judas Window, The Problem of the Green Capsule, you're getting into these stories building kind of to a culmination and maybe Till Death Do Us Part in sense of his timing and plotting of the story. Now, I'd argue that Merivale kind of continues his first era for longer, though. If we look at The Judas Window, this is somewhat along the lines of, you know, his earlier classic Impossibilities. It may be written and paced a little bit better. The Reader is Warned, that feels very much in the same range of books for Merivale, whereas Fell's made this transition into a slightly different storytelling.
It's interesting to see you've got The Reader is Warned and The Man Who Could Not Shudder. Again, thematically very similar. What's going on in those books in terms of how the problems are set up, very, very similar. As a reading experience, they almost couldn't be more different.
You're right.
They were published one after the other, and they are such different actual reading experiences. It's phenomenal.
I had to pull myself a bit through the first half of The Man Who Could Not Shudder.
Did you really?
It's an excellent book after that, but maybe it was fatigue at this point, but I'm like, oh, it's another big house with a lot of rich people, and I got to learn all these names. It just didn't feel like it had that hook of a lot of the books that were surrounding it. It kind of stands out on its own.
That's fair enough. It's one of the things where you hear the problem. It's like, oh, somebody was shot by a gun that was floating in midair, and there's no way, like, nobody was near it, and you go, oh well, there was a thread on it, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, it was,
yes,
whatever. Yeah. There was a fine cotton thread. So obviously this is not the solution. There was a fine cotton thread. No.
I thought you said no spoilers.
Yeah.
That's the book I'm writing, and I just loved it. But anyway, that's.
Well, I think it has to do with that setup, right? Which is you have to set up an impossibility enough to really believe in it.
Yeah, that's fair.
If you don't, it starts to fall down flat a little bit. And this is where I think The Man Who Could Not Shudder actually succeeds, in that it becomes something much more than you ever had in your mind.
The solution of who is responsible for the shooting in that book. Just, it's gorgeous. It is gorgeous.
Absolutely.
I'm to get to this one, so that's the problem with these discussions. You're like, okay, I'll read that one next.
Okay, now.
No, wait, no, I'll read that one next. I'm not
giving anything away, but look out for who has the cotton thread in their pocket.
Yeah, sure.
The first couple of phases of Carr's career, then, you have Merivale coming in as this very serious, impossible crime focused detective. Fell, we've seen, gradually adopting the mantle of the impossible crime. There must therefore be, well, there is therefore, the decline of Merivale very much. It starts to feel as if Fell is where the majority of Carr's efforts are going. Is that fair? Is there a point where you think we start to see Merivale sort of dropping away and some like bifurcation, I guess, between the two characters?
I really think that we start to see it with Seeing is Believing in 1941. Carr releases, you know, a series of books, Seeing is Believing, The Gilded Man, She Died a Lady. And I mean, you have some strong titles in there. You know, Seeing is Believing is still very much that impossible crime setup. How was a man stabbed by his hypnotized wife in front of a crowd? And yet we don't see it pay off. The Gilded Man is a very compelling, fast read. It's good, but it's not really great. But in both these books, we start to see Merivale emerge as a comical character. Now, I think that the comedy is done acceptably at first, but as we start to edge into She Died a Lady, which I think many would say is one of Carr's better books, we start to get this very slapstick image of Merivale that kind of carries through to the rest of his career, where in The Curse of the Bronze Lamp, he's cutting off people's ties. The Cavalier's Cup is probably 90% comedy and, you know, 10% a mystery that would have been better suited for a 20-page short story.
I maintain He Wouldn't Kill Patience is almost a perfect book, apart from the opening two-chapter period where Merivale gets bitten on the arse by a poisonous snake or something, and it's just like, oh, look at him hilariously capering around. And once you get that out of the way, it knuckles down and starts doing its job properly and it becomes amazing. But it's almost like Carr feels an obligation to get in some ridiculous Merivale behaviour somehow. He is this very, in scare quotes, funny character all of a sudden.
I think I like that scene a bit more than you did, but
everybody likes that scene more than I despise that
you're
scene.
Downcast man, you are. And yeah, I think there becomes a temptation, or I don't know, maybe it becomes a trope that the introduction then of Merivale in each book is like this explosive, hilarious, the same in She Died a Lady, come flying down the road in the kind of wheelchair thing, and you know, all different ways of kind of bringing him in. It's always got to be this kind of slapstick thing.
And then conversely, Fell in the Carr books is this almost totemic, incredibly serious, almost mythical figure. You look at the way he dispels so much of the mistreatment of Fae Seton in the likes of He Who Whispers, where he is this incredibly serious, very focused on the power of stories, on the power of impressions being used to mislead things. As Merivale is almost being diluted in terms of his portrayal, Fell is almost assuming the mantle. It's almost as if Carr has carved a lot of the serious edges off of Merivale and is just sticking them onto Fell as past as he possibly can. I can't think of anything even moderately comical about Fell. You know, he stops harumphing quite so much. He stops being such a figure of fun as Merivale becomes more and more of a figure of fun.
Yes, and with that, we lose almost the mystery focus of those Merivale novels. I mean, you definitely have these strong titles in there, She Died a Lady. I think Seeing is Believing has a really tight setup. The Gilded Man certainly isn't bad, but you start to, you know, compare that to the Fell novels at the time, Till Death Do Us Part, He Who Whispers, even, I might say, Below Suspicion, which, you know, maybe is a controversial choice there, but a fairly tight mystery. Whereas if you somewhat follow the arc of Merivale at this time, you're hitting books like Night at the Mocking Window and The Cavalier's Cup behind the Crimson Blind that a lot of people think are just atrocious.
Are we getting into another phase of Carr's career after this? Because after this, then, we start to see Bride of Newgate, Devil in Velvet, much more in terms of the historicals of which he became known in his later career. So is this then the next phase?
Obviously, that is the next phase. but I feel there's enough in the episode at this point that this would be a good place to stop. We'll make this an edit point so that people are able to have a focused discussion over these first two couple of ages, and we will make the historicals and everything on from there a separate episode that will go up next week. Dan and Ben and I are going to keep talking. That will then become a second episode, the historicals onwards and various other things. In the meantime, obviously we love your thoughts on what we have discussed so far, so get involved in the comments below, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to this first part. See you next Saturday. Thank you very much.